chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وكأين من نبي قاتل معه ربيون كثير فما وهنوا لما أصابهم في سبيل الله وما ضعفوا وما استكانوا والله يحب الصابرين وما كان قولهم إلا أن قالوا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord. So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair. And make firm our feet, and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world, and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
Good morning to all our listeners. You are tuned in to Iran radio broadcast from Tehran. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. The Islamic world produced the first skilled, specially trained pharmacists who made their own medicines and worked closely with medical doctors and physicians. A 13th century Islamic writer described the circulation of blood inside the human body some 400 years before this was discovered in Europe. One famous hadith Islamic saying is, Allah is beautiful and loves beauty. Beauty has always been, therefore, very important to Muslims and develops in the virtual arts such as architecture, calligraphy, painting, textile, metalwork, and ceramists were encouraged. On the continuation of Iran Radio, we'll listen to this part. We start off this hour's programs with our news bulletin. That will be followed by the Ocean of Dua. The program explains supplications and prayers taken from various books such as Mafatihul Jinan and Kamilu Ziyarat. And we round up this hour with our varied radio productions feature.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines of Palestinian NGO Network calls on the international community to declare Gaza a humanitarian disaster area and take urgent measures to lift the Israeli blockade. Based on a new survey, the majority of Germans are opposed to the government's military support for Israel. And also in our headlines, Venezuela warns international airlines to resume flights to the country within 48 hours or risk being stripped of their flight clearance altogether. Palestinian NGO Network has sounded a serious alarm of the catastrophic humanitarian situation in Gaza as winter approaches. The network called on the international community to declare the territory a, quote, humanitarian disaster area. The warning came as the Palestinians in Gaza complain about their desperate situation due to Israeli blockade of aid supplies despite the ceasefire.
All night we couldn't sleep or do anything. We were just holding mops and worn-out tents with water coming in from every direction. Children are drowning drenched in water and we're practically swimming.
This suffering, this rain, and the weather depressions haven't even started yet. It's only the beginning of winter, and we're already flooded. We haven't received tents or tarps. The tarp and the tent are 2 years old. They're completely worn out and we're drowning.
The network also called for urgent global measures to ensure the protection of civilians in Gaza and lift the territory's blockade. It stressed that rescue efforts are necessary for thousands of displaced people whose tents and shelters have been swept away by torrential rains and floods. The network also called for urgent delivery of tents and supplies needed to rehabilitate shelters, along with the immediate provision of relief and food aid. It noted that Gaza's civil defense teams and the health sector must be activated, and Israeli restrictions on the entry of essential goods must end. The network added that according to the latest international reports, more than 90% of Gaza's population suffers from malnutrition due to severe food shortages and scarcity of potable water amid ongoing Israeli bombardments and daily military strikes. Political analyst Sarah Flounders believes that Trump's peace plan for Gaza is a complete fraud, and Washington is actually a guarantor of the ongoing genocide in the war-torn territory.
In my opinion, what this means is that the U.S., as the guarantor of this grand peace plan ran through even the U.N. Security Council, they are the guarantors of a humanitarian disaster, of a continuing genocide. It's a complete fraud, and yet they signed on and said they would guarantee that these supplies would be released, that there would be food, that there would be shelter, the most basic shelter. We're talking about tarps and tents in wintertime. We're talking about basic nutritious food, and yet none of that is being provided. It's being provided in levels so scarce, so tiny, that 90% of the population is still suffering serious malnutrition. Now, this is a real disaster. And we've got to say that for the countries that guaranteed this agreement, that they are also responsible, along with the Zionists, along with this Israeli blockade.
The Secretary General of the United Nations has reaffirmed the Palestinian people have the right to dignity, justice, and self-determination, just like all other nations. Antonio Guterres was addressing a special meeting marking the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. He emphasized that Establishing an independent state is the legitimate right of the Palestinian people. The UN chief also renewed his call for an end to the illegal occupation of Palestinian territories as affirmed by the International Court of Justice. And the UN General Assembly Guterres described the Gaza ceasefire agreement as a glimmer of hope, calling on all parties to fully adhere to it and move quickly to the next phase. He also touched on the devastation caused in Gaza by 2 years of Israeli aggression, including the killing of thousands of people, widespread destruction of infrastructure, and the spread of hunger, disease, and psychological trauma. Guterres said the number of journalists killed over the past 2 years exceeds that of any conflict since World War II, with the majority being Palestinians. A new poll indicates that over 80% of Germans oppose their government's military support for Israel. The survey also found that nearly three-quarters of respondents want Berlin to apply stronger diplomatic pressure on Israel. The survey shows a major shift in public opinion, with 60% rejecting the traditional stance that Germany has special responsibility towards Israel. The poll also reflects a widening gap between government policy and public sentiment. Berlin supplied Israel with arms worth more than 490 million euros from October 7, 2023 to June 5, 2025. Amid rising public pressure, Germany in August imposed restrictions on weapons sale to the Tel Aviv regime as that ammunition could be used in the genocidal war on Gaza. However, Berlin lifted the restrictions this week. The United Nations says despite the conclusion of the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Lebanon, the regime has intensified its attacks on the Arab country, killing scores of civilians. According to the UN Human Rights Office, at least 127 civilians have been killed in Lebanon since the ceasefire deal entered into force about a year ago. In one of the deadliest attacks last week, over a dozen civilians, mostly children, were killed in the Ain al-Hilwa camp for Palestinian refugees in southern Lebanon. The office added that there are serious concerns that Israel's attack on the Ain al-Hilwa camp may have violated international humanitarian law. It called for a prompt and impartial investigation into the regime's strike. The UN Humanitarian Office added that Israel's attacks on Lebanon have also destroyed civilian infrastructure and hampered reconstruction efforts and attempts by internally displaced people to go back home. It said over 64,000 people, mostly residents of southern Lebanon, remain displaced in other parts of the country. Brazil's Supreme Court has ordered former President Jair Bolsonaro to begin serving his 27-year prison sentence as his conviction for plotting a coup. The far-right politician was convicted in September after the Supreme Court ruled he orchestrated a criminal conspiracy to block his left-wing rival Lula da Silva from taking office. Investigators say the plot included plans to assassinate Lula and his running mate. The conspiracy, however, failed to get the backing of the army and air force commanders. Bolsonaro and his six allies were later found guilty of attempting to, quote, annihilate Brazilian democracy and restore dictatorship. He's been under house arrest since August. Well, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has vowed to defend his country against any imperialist threat, urging unity among civilians, politicians, and armed forces.
I tell our people, if Bolivar could build 7 army corps to liberate all of South America and secure the independence of Central America. I tell our people, if Bolivar could build 7 army corps to liberate all of South America and secure the independence of Central America and beyond, we must be able to defend every inch of this blessed land from any imperialist threat or aggression, wherever and whenever it comes. Stay alert, stay alert.
Maduro made the remarks during a civic military march in Caracas. The rally was held as tensions have been on the rise between Caracas and Washington since the U.S. military began strikes on alleged drug trafficking boats in the Caribbean. The U.S. State Department has designated the Cartel de los Soles a foreign terrorist organization. That's a group allegedly headed by Maduro. The Venezuelan Foreign Ministry described the designation as a ridiculous fabrication. Meanwhile, Caracas has warned international airlines to resume flights to the Latin American country within 48 hours or risk being stripped of their clearance to fly there altogether. It came after several airlines suspended their flights to Venezuela following a Friday warning by the U.S. aviation regulator about heightened military activity in the area. Democratic lawmakers who appeared in a social media video calling on U.S. troops to defy illegal orders say the FBI has contacted them to begin scheduling interviews. Let's now listen to one of those six lawmakers, Michigan Senator Elisa Slotkin.
And then last night, the counterterrorism division at the FBI sent a note to members of Congress saying they are opening what appears to be an inquiry against the six of us. To be honest, the president's reaction and the use of the FBI against us is exactly why we made the video. He believes in using the federal government against his perceived adversaries.
Slotkin revealed the inquiry has coincided with the surge in threats, including a bomb scare at her farm. She added that she and five other lawmakers are receiving round-the-clock protection from Capitol Police after her family's safety was disrupted. The 90-second video warned that the Trump administration was pitting uniformed military against American citizens. Trump responded by accusing them of sedition and demanding their arrest. Iran is pushing forward with homegrown satellite mapping, marine charting, and GPS precision systems. The new developments announced in a joint press briefing by the head of Iran's Armed Forces Geographical Organization and the National Mapping Organization signal the country's determination to lead regional geospatial innovation. Gisumi Shahmadi has more.
Digital mapping and satellite-based positioning now form the backbone of national planning.
As Iran advances in marine cartography and spatial science, officials say that keeping pace with emerging technologies is key to sustainable development, both on land and at sea.
During a joint press conference, recent major breakthroughs highlighted. Head of the National Cartographic Center of Iran emphasizing the importance of collaboration among academic, military, and private sectors.
One of our key projects at the National Mapping Organization is ensuring policymakers have prompt access to precise geographic data and maps. This improves crisis management and planning. The 12-day war taught us to always be prepared, especially in delivering accurate data. And that requires self-reliance in the relevant technologies we are developing.
And to further advance Iran's self-reliance in position and satellite imagery, the national launch of the Atlas Award for Geomatic Technology Innovation, with a focus turned to homegrown GPS modules, AI-based image processors, and marine mapping instruments designed to cover Iran's coastal waters with 1 meter accuracy.
We have now unveiled the Atlas National Award for Technology Innovation in Geomatics. It is designed to recognize researchers, build an ecosystem for innovation, and create a platform for investors and the private sector, with the goal of exporting the technologies we develop.
The Atlas Award will serve as a benchmark for everyone active in the geomatics field. It offers clear incentives for winners and encourages fresh developments across the sector.
Beyond defense or navigation, officials argue that spatial technologies are now central to environmental sustainability and disaster preparedness, translating data from satellites into decision-making tools for policymakers.
Iran's strides for homegrown cartography aim to sharpen geographic data on climate and water resources in order to provide better environmental policies for the future. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Iran's top security official, Ali Darijani, is on an official visit to Pakistan. His trip is part of an intensified diplomatic push by the two countries to strengthen political, security, and economic cooperation. Our correspondent, Asa Kazmi, reports from Islamabad.
Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Darijani, arrived in Pakistan on Monday. His visit marks a significant step in the ongoing efforts by both countries to consolidate cooperation amid heightened regional tensions. Shortly after his arrival, Larajani met Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, President Asif Ali Zardari, Deputy Prime Minister Ishaq Dar, and other high-ranking officials and think tank heads, engaging in wide-ranging discussions on bilateral ties and regional security. The discussions focused on expanding bilateral trade, with both sides reiterating their commitment to removing trade barriers, activating the barter trade mechanism, and expediting the Pakistan-Iran Free Trade Agreement. Larajani also praised Pakistan's support for Iran during the U.S.-Israeli aggression against the country earlier this year.
We discussed all key bilateral matters, especially how to expand our economic cooperation and strengthen trade. Pakistan is a true brotherly nation, and together we explored practical ways to deepen our security ties, enhance people-to-people contact, and coordinate our positions on major international issues.
Pakistani leadership underscored Islamabad's commitment to deepening political, economic, and security cooperation with Tehran.
We discussed all the regional, bilateral, and global issues. It was a wonderful meeting. I'm grateful to my brother Excellency for his visit and sparing time to meet with me. And we had very open discussion about all the issues which are currently being faced by the regional and the multilateral forums.
Observers say Larajani's visit signals a strategic recalibration in Iran's regional engagement after the June war with Israel. They say the visit also underscores Pakistan's rising relevance in Tehran's long-term vision, particularly in border security, regional trade, and balanced diplomacy in a volatile neighborhood.
We are proud of Iran's resistance. They have set a new example because they have shattered the myth of Israeli invincibility through the determination, through the will, and the fighting power of the Iranian nation. And we feel that Iran showed that imperialism, hegemony, Zionism, they say might is right, right is might, and they failed miserably in that.
Larajani is the second high-ranking Iranian official to visit Pakistan this month, after Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bakar Kalibaf.
The latest high-level meetings between the top officials of Iran and Pakistan show that the two neighbors are not only focused on boosting trade and economic partnerships, but also on developing coordinated mechanisms for regional peace and security. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
And man was burning and keeping the light alive. A bone in his throat, a thorn in his eyes. In silence, and man was burning and keeping the light.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Murarisi here with another special edition of this program, The Ocean of Dua. In this special edition and during this sacred and holy month of Ramadan, we'll try to talk about some parts of Iftitah supplication, and we'll be bringing you the commentary on some parts of this supplication. We'll be back again after you listen to some parts of this dua, so stay with us.
Alhamdulillah, الذي لا يهتك حجابه ولا يغلق بابه ولا يرد سائله ولا يخيب آمنه.
Praise be to Allah. No one can disclose anything hidden by him, and no one can shut the doors kept open by him, and no one who makes a request is sent away disappointed by him. So you can see that in this part of the dua, the Almighty Allah is saying that he will never reject his servants, he will never close his doors of mercy on them, and he will never allow them to lose hope. But it is possible that out of personal motives, we do something for a person and remind him of this favor. I did it for your sake. But we cannot do this to God because he is aware of our intention and motives. The expression by the will of God is good, but we must be sincere in our words and deeds. Usually, out of the 100 times that we make this expression, only once we truly mean it.
La ilaha illallah. Allah.
As stated in the supplication, if a person really pins his hopes on God, no one who looks long and attentively is deluded in his hopes. So, the conclusion is, if we become hopeless, it is because we have not actually pinned our hope on God, and we haven't actually done our duty with reliance on Him. If we like an activity, we do it with great enthusiasm. But if we do not like it, or it requires a lot of effort and patience, either we do not do it, or we do it sluggishly. For example, in doing something, if the means to do that is accessible to us, we tend to do it. Otherwise, we consider it impossible to be done, and we tell everybody, and we inform everyone that we cannot possibly do that because it's impossible to be done. But if we do something with the hope that someone will come to rescue or assist us, but he does not come, we tend to be discouraged in continuing it. Even in simple worldly matters, we tend to look for a friend or acquaintance to assist us. And this only shows that we do not actually pin our hope to God. God has not guaranteed the realization of such hopes. Imam Ali alayhi salam has a very interesting saying about pinning your hope on God. Hazrat Ali alayhi salam has said, يَدَّعِي أَنَّهُ يَرْجُ اللَّهِ. He claimed, according to his own assumptions, he hopes for Allah. كَذَبَ وَالْعَظِيمِ. By Allah the Great he lies. مَا بَالُهُ لَا يَتَبَيَّنُ رَجَاءُهُ فِي عَمَلِهِ. Do not one's hopes become visible through one's actions? فَكُلُّ مَنَ الرَّجَاء عُرِفَ رَجَاءُهُ فِي عَمَلِهِ. The hope of everyone who hopes is known through his own actions. يَرْجُ اللَّهَ فِي الْكَبِيرِ وَيَرْجُ الْعِبَادَ فِي الصَّغِيرِ. He hopes big things from Allah and small things from the man. فَيُعْتِ الْعَبْدَ مَا لَا يُعْتِ الرَّبِّ. But he gives to man such consideration as he does not give to Allah. Then Imam Ali alayhi salam continues, what is the matter with Allah? Glorified be His praise. He is accorded less consideration than what is given to His creatures.
The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it, and whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which He has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
So, as you can see, Imam Ali alayhi salam has said that if a person is hopeful of something, he strives to achieve it. Hope urges man to toil and sweat. A youngster who hopes that by obtaining a degree he will find a suitable job and a good social standing will strive hard for years, 24/7, day and night. He can even tolerate being away from home and everything else. Why? Because it is that he has hope. That hope has kept him alive. He hopes that by obtaining a certain degree, he will acquire a suitable job. So it is the hope that produces movement. I mean, if you do have hope, laziness and inertia will go away, and you will try and strive hard for obtaining whatever it is you are trying to achieve. This topic is yet to be continued. There are many questions about the hope and having action at the same time that will, inshallah, be answered to in the next programs. Thank you for staying with us. We ask the Almighty Allah to bestow on us the power and bravery to face dreadful events and situations in our lives. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. English Radio.
Hello and welcome back to Attrition. I'm your host, Ahmad Kazmi, and I continue to be joined by independent British journalist Sarah Wilkinson. Sarah is a long-standing campaigner for Palestinian liberation. Sarah, in part one of the programme, we spoke about the repression that you faced from the British state for your journalism on Palestine, and we were talking about the way in which the police operate here in Britain. We know that they're an arm of the state, but they're supposed to be operationally independent, but it seems that now they're not even operationally independent, right? There's just this pipeline of demands coming from the regime in Tel Aviv to the British government and then passed on to the police. And then this goes to a question that seems to rile up a lot of people, but which I think is very important, which is who exactly is driving this push to silence pro-Palestine voices in Britain? I have my own view on that. Some people say that it just comes directly and organically from the British state, which supports Israel because it's simply a Western colonial outpost. But I think that oversimplifies the question, because we saw, particularly under Jeremy Corbyn when he was leader of the Labour Party, how the Israel lobby in Britain intensified and battle-tested new censorship methods to go after pro-Palestine voices in Britain. And that came from the Zionist entity. It didn't come from Britain. We saw how the former Israel ambassador to Britain, Mark Regev, worked to push these strategies. That's when we had the widespread rollout of an official definition of anti-Semitism with the IHRA working definition. We had the revival of a group like the Jewish Labour Movement to help take down Jeremy Corbyn. We saw the case of Shai Massot, the Zionist spy, working to take down even a conservative minister, Sir Alan Duncan. And it seems to me that the British state has been, over the past decade especially, increasingly captured and radicalized by the Zionist regime. And would you agree with that assessment, which is basically that the scale of the push against pro-Palestine journalists, activists and protesters here in Britain is primarily being pushed by external forces? And what's your take on that?
I was waiting for you to say occupied. Are we occupied? And yes, we are. Everything's coming straight out of the Tel Aviv playbook. Even the questions in interrogations, they're no longer following British protocol. You know, some of my interrogation questions were just outright racist. I think one of them, you know, why do you think Palestinian people are better than white people? I mean, I just find that an astonishing question. And it's clearly not a British question. So are we occupied? Yes, indeed. I think that we are very much so. So although, yes, it seems to be coming from the British government, you know, like, it's not just that we're allies, because as I've said before, who would have an ally that murders and maims? Well, yeah, the numbers are 70,000, but, you know, we know that even if you look at the Lancet, you know, they were guessing the figures were over 200,000 Palestinians killed. I know that there's 15 or 16,000 Palestinian children missing. So on top of nearly 30,000 killed, there's hundreds of thousands of adults and children missing. So who'd have an ally that is murdering at this extent? Who would actually brag about having the same values as an entity that is basically using mass murder to ethnically cleanse an entire population? Who'd do that? And I can't believe that the British public aren't more shocked when you hear Ursula von der Leyen and talking about, well, we have, you know, similar values. It's, well, no, we don't. I don't know anyone who has the same value as a regime that is prepared to annihilate an entire population. And that annihilation is still going on. Let's not forget this yellow line that they've created. Then now this morning they've announced that they're moving the yellow line outwards to take more of Gaza's territory. And that yellow line obviously has about another 250 metres in front of it, where suddenly these yellow blocks appear. And let's not forget, it isn't a spray-painted yellow line. It's an invisible yellow line, and it's an excuse to continue the genocide, to continue killing innocent Palestinians, young children playing football, just who accidentally cross over this invisible line. The genocide, the ceasefire, they're one and the same. The ceasefire is just, I think I've used this phrase before, but it's a rebranded version of genocide. And I've also used the phrase of, you know, this is a Rubik's cube of genocide. So we're not just talking about starvation and disease. We're not talking about, you know, destroying the hospitals and the infrastructure, the sewage, creating a situation where hepatitis becomes rife and then there are no medications, the polio virus, you know, the bad weather, the fact that the pipelines are all destroyed. If you look at everything that the Israelis have done and are doing, then it becomes this Rubik's Cube of genocide. It may not look the same every day, but it will still be a combination. And so, you know, even with this, am I going to call it a peace plan? No, it's a genocide plan that has been manufactured by the Israelis and the Americans, which they've also called, was it a board of peace? Oh, they're all such lovely words, aren't they? And a stabilization force to enable them to continue the genocide, but using these very lovely words. And it means that they can make the public relax. Oh, how do you feel now the war is over? I can't tell you how many times that has been said to me. And I've had to say, it's not over. The genocide never finished. It's continuing. It's going on. But it's just got nicer words around it so people think that it's finished. People, I mean, was it 29 people killed this morning? Dozens of children. And then 25 people killed yesterday. These are airstrikes. It's continuing to to bomb Gaza. So I don't know where the ceasefire fits into that, because as far as I'm concerned, that isn't a ceasefire. That isn't, they're not stopping anything. They're continuing with the ethnic cleansing by death, or even by trying to bus them out and then fly them into South Africa. I'm glad South Africa has now put a stop to it. May get some criticism for it, but the point is it didn't want to be a party to ethnic cleansing. And that's what we're all complicit with. If we don't speak out as journalists, if we don't speak out as reporters and activists, if we don't keep telling the world this, they actually do sit back as if they were just watching an episode of Coronation Street and think it's all over. And the thing is, it isn't. We're halfway through. The ethnic cleansing isn't complete, and they will continue until it is complete. I may have strayed off your question a little bit. It's because there's so much of it, and it's because I think the general public have been conned. They've been conned by words. And I'd like to think they're a little bit more intelligent than that. It's disappearing out of mainstream media, certainly. And people keep saying now the war is over all the time. And for a start off, it was never a war. It was a genocide. And now we have this Trump-Netanyahu genocide plan, which is against the Geneva Conventions, which is against the Apartheid Conventions, it's against the Genocide Convention. And yeah, I kind of want people to wake up.
Well, let's turn now to those ongoing developments. So, of course, you're talking about the recent UN Security Council resolution, which is this Western-imposed colonial trusteeship, or a mandate, if you will, that seeks to dissolve Palestinian governance in Gaza, hand temporary administration of the land, well, they say temporary, but I think they mean permanent administration of the land, the same powers that armed Israel's genocide, to disarm the occupied people, or attempt to disarm them. I don't think they'll be very successful in doing that, while also throwing Palestinian statehood to the wind. I mean, what's your reading beyond what you've just said on what that signals about the future?
I think, isn't that what they always wanted? This was always the plan, you know, to dissolve Palestinian statehood, to prevent the Palestinians' right of return, which is an inalienable right, by the way, to, you know, not to have to pay reparation costs, to create a situation where Gaza is uninhabitable, to then, say, use voluntary migration, which is enforced migration, to get them out there, to continue killing, to find a way to continue the genocide but under a different form. Isn't that what they were always doing? I can't actually see the difference. This is exactly the same, but it's got some very pretty words around it. And now somebody's gone and voted. And I think the United Nations Security Council, oh my God, how spineless do they have to be? I don't know whether I was the only one praying for Russia and China to veto it. But no, it was worse than that. They abstained, which is like, we might have vetoed it, but we decided that we'd do a trade and stay and just stay quiet. I mean, it's even worse. So, you know, you're waiting for somebody to stand up and say, this can't go on. This plan is just about legitimizing genocide. It's about taking away accountability. And it's about allowing the Israelis to take Gaza over. Well, isn't that what they were always trying to do? Isn't that what they were doing when they were bombing it? And they are still bombing it. But isn't that what they did when they originally invaded it? Isn't that what has been happening for 77 years? I can't see how this plan is different from the illegal occupation. And as you rightly said, you know, occupations are supposed to be temporary. Here we have a permanent one. We have dozens of violations of international law just inside this, oh, I'm going to keep calling it a peace plan and I really don't want to, just inside this Trump-Netanyahu genocide plan are multiple violations of not just the Geneva Convention, but, you know, international law itself, multiple violations. It is disabling the Palestinians, the right to self-governance. There's nothing in this plan which is aimed at giving the Palestinians what they've always wanted and always resisted for, which is self-determination, which is the chance to actually belong to their own land and own their own land and govern their own land in their own way. No matter who they vote for, you know, it's removing their ability to continue living there. Well, isn't that what they were doing in the first place? This is just a different side of the Rubik's Cube. And it's a clever one because, you know, there are people that think, oh, you know, Trump's a hero, you know, he's come along and he's going to make peace. He hasn't made peace. You know, if 29 Palestinian people are slaughtered in one morning and then the day before another 25 and 13 children the day before. I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure where that is peace. I'm not quite sure if you want to call that an incremental genocide because the numbers are smaller. Well, you know, eventually you will carry on and you'll have an entire genocide. Nothing has changed. I was even thinking about the Colombian peace plan when I read it. You know, everything was good until they said, you know, but of course, you know, we would like the Israelis to continue being able to have Jerusalem as their capital. Okay, so previous to that, they had stated that they had to withdraw back to the 1948 lines and, you know, they had to pull out and then no more settlements. And then they say, oh, but you can still have Jerusalem as your capital. So how in God's name do you do that when you've got to ethnically cleanse Jerusalem of the Palestinians? So in some ways, it completely contradicted the beginning of what they were trying to say. Theirs was the best plan. But at the end of the day, it's still once again an excuse to continue ethnically cleansing Palestine, central Palestine, Jerusalem. And then, oh, but we'll give you Abu Dhabi, we'll give you East Jerusalem as your capital, which is actually a rubbish dump. Now, I don't mean to insult Abu Dhabi. There are people that live there, and it's their environment, and it's their home, but it's been turned into a rubbish dump. And so that's what's going to become the Palestinian capital when Jerusalem is their capital. I can't see how anything's changed. It's just been relabeled. That's my point of view anyway.
Well, I mean, people talk about the fact that the Nakba never ended, that it's an ongoing Nakba. And it seems to me, quite rightly, as you've pointed out, that it really nothing has changed. All that changes is the pace and also the framing around the genocide. But the genocide always continues. And of course, that was always the Zionist plan. Even if you look at the so-called Labour Zionists, who were the majority back then and sort of considered the more moderate wing of Zionism, not that there is any such thing. But David Ben-Gurion and the Labour Zionists, who of course were the people who created the Haganah, which then became the Israel Occupation Forces, and which carried out numerous massacres alongside Zionist terrorist organizations during the Nakba, they were very clear right at the beginning that they would only accept a partitioned state so that they could eventually take over the rest of Palestine. And of course, that comes with, as I think Ben-Gurion said, brutal compulsion and also expulsion of the indigenous people, and not just their expulsion, but also their mass slaughter, of course, as we have seen. You made reference earlier to the Great Israel Project, which is the Zionist expansionist plan to conquer all of historic Palestine, as well as to absorb parts of Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and beyond. In the West, for many years, this has often been treated as some sort of conspiracy theory, but the Zionists talk openly about it, and they talk more openly about it now than they ever have before. And we even saw Netanyahu recently visit some of the newly annexed land, or the newly occupied land, I should say, in Syria. How serious is this Great Israel plan, and what effects could that have for the region in the coming months and years?
I do hate making predictions because they often come true, but there was a time when it wasn't okay to talk about the Greater Israel Project. People did think, you're right, that you were a conspiracy theorist, but it's absolutely true. And I wonder whether some of our arrests and our trials and our court cases have been perfectly timed around 2027, 2028, and the end of 2026, when you will see a much bigger expansion going on. And that could very very likely, when you, you know, when they said they were going to bomb Gaza back to the Stone Ages, well, we're looking at Lebanon could very easily end up in this situation. We've only seen a small taste of it at the moment, and the southern Lebanon is being bombed and people are being killed, and now they're attacking a Palestinian refugee camp. But you know, a lot of Lebanese people, as we know, have been slaughtered, and the pager incident. And, you know, I think what we're going to see over the next coming year and towards the end of the year is a real push. The Greater Israel Project is going to actually start to become a reality. And by then it'll be too late. You know, the Israelis have played the better chess game, and we're sitting around just moving pawns around the chessboard. But it's going to happen. And I think Lebanon is a target. I actually think Jordan is a very big target, but I get into trouble for saying it. But I also think Syria, you know, and obviously there's parts of Saudi Arabia that are very much involved in losing their land to the Greater Israel Project, and North Sinai, I think of the two places. And if you look at the Greater Israel Project, that takes the Suez Canal as well. So, you know, I know that the Egyptian people are very supportive of Palestine, so this is not against the Egyptian people, but Sisi is being very careless about one of his main sources of income, and that's not just the tourist industry over the pyramids, but the Suez Canal. Now, if you look at the Greater Israel Project map, that includes the Suez Canal, that includes parts of Saudi Arabia, that includes pretty much most of Lebanon. I don't know what is going to be left of Lebanon. And I think if the countries don't start rising up, and rising up very quickly, you know, it's difficult when you've got America sort of pressing down on you, but, you know, if something isn't done very swiftly, I think that the same time that we are no longer able to post, we are no longer able to work as journalists and reporters. Don't forget, that's 250, Palestinian journalists have already been slaughtered, but we're also looking at the silencing of hundreds of very big, people with very big platforms. That is when I think it will all happen. And this is a preparation. This taking us to court, accusing us of this, accusing us of that, trying to jail the people that have been on YouTube, like Richie Medhurst, you know, trying to jail Craig Murray, trying to jail myself, I suppose, trying to jail anybody who's been outspoken or anybody who's prepared to tell the truth tellers. Then it's all going to happen at that time when we become silent. And this is, you know, I've got a sort of, I suppose I'm not very positive about all of these court cases, because they do not want people exposing these plans. And how do we expose them? We expose them through social media. It's going to be difficult to stop people. There's a legal reason why they can't stop people using social media. The only way they can silence us is to jail us. And when we are all jailed, that is when you're going to see all of these things start happening, this mad push to start taking more and more territory in Syria, but Lebanon in particular, and Jordan. You know, I feel that Jordan is a holding platter. I mean, there's a lot of Palestinian refugees live there, but, you know, it is also a sovereign country whose king could be forced into exile. The Greater Israel Project is actually one of the most dangerous things that we have ahead of us. And in some ways, the British state is preparing a way. It's preparing a pathway so that it can do it. It knows BBC isn't going to cover it. It knows that the mainstream news is not going to cover it. So it's got to silence all of the people that would cover it. And funnily enough, when you look at all of the names of the people who've been arrested, those are the ones who are most prolific on social media, on Twitter or other platforms, telling the world, wake up, this is happening. Now, they silence all of us. They're just going to quietly get along with it. And I think this is why the dates of the trials are done specifically, because these things are going to start happening by the end of 2026. I would be surprised if you don't see a lot more bombing in Palestine, maybe the destruction of Al-Aqsa Mosque, which I think will make a lot of people gasp But I do think the collapse of Al-Aqsa Mosque is imminent if they continue their excavations. Maybe all this will happen by the end of 2026 when we've all been silenced and we're unable to report about it. Hopefully somebody will fill in. But at the moment, people are terrified. People are terrified to take over, if you like, posting 30 to 50 tweets per day. It actually takes up your whole day. It's a full-time job. There isn't really anybody else doing it. So all of those investigative journalists, we're all being silenced. And I think we're being silenced for a reason. And the Greater Israel Project is the reason. And it has begun already. I think Francesca Albanese said it's already begun. And I think she's right. But it hasn't begun on a big enough scale that it's noticeable. And so they're getting away with it. I do fear the amount of arrests that are being made because they are prolific reporters and activists. And they're the ones that we need to pass on to the next generation. That something big is going down, something bad is happening, and your government is facilitating it. Do something about it. Get out on the streets. There is no ceasefire. This is all a ruse to make you relax. And so, yeah, it's another part of the Rubik's Cube.
Well, with that, I'm afraid we're going to have to call our conversation to an end. I really appreciate the insights that you've been able to give, Sarah, and I want to express my support and solidarity with you. I want to wish you the very best of luck with your case. And I'd ask anyone who's listening to follow you and also your work if they aren't already doing so. Sarah, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you.
See you next time.
Good day to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio, and here are some interesting facts about Islam. During the Middle Ages, the Muslim world had two numerous business advantages. They had a huge range of contacts, so they could trade everything from African gold to Chinese porcelain to European amber and furs. And Muslim craft workers were highly skilled, which meant their goods always found a really market. Without Muslim merchants, Europeans would have had no rice, sugar, or coffee. Approximately 5 to 8 million Muslims lived in the United States, and there are over 1,200 mosques. Muslims have been a part of the cultural landscape in America for the past 200 years. The Islamic Empire once stretched into modern-day Europe, particularly in Spain and the Balkans. Today, there are tens of millions of Muslims living in Europe. Now we'll listen to the continuation of our schedule on Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. Then it's time for Insights into the Holy Quran. The program presents a short exegesis or explanation of the ayahs of the Holy Quran. Our radio productions feature will again follow after this. And we round up this hour's programs with